Welcome to episode 205 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and joining me is Anthony Horowitz to talk about his new crime fiction novel, Moonflower Murders, which was published in the UK in August and will be published in North America on November 10th. Thanks so much for joining me, Anthony.
It's a pleasure, Nancy. Thank you for having me.
I'm a big fan, and I'm so thrilled to have you on the podcast for many, many reasons. But perhaps the biggest is Susan Ryland, the protagonist of Moonflower Murders, as well as its predecessor, Magpie Murders. She's an editor and the hero of the book. And I can't tell you what that means to this old editor. And so how did she come about?
Well, first of all, I think it is lovely that she is an editor. It's great to write a detective story where your main character is not actually a detective. It casts a completely new light on everything. And in Magpie Murders, in fact, the entire solution to the crime was something that only an editor would spot. And that's also, to an extent, true of the sequel, Moonflower Murders. She came about largely because I had a wonderful editor when I was at Orion Books. My editor was called Susan Lamb, and therein the name lies the secret, because a Ryland is a breed of lamb. So hence Susan Lamb to Susan Ryland. And she's very much based on that character, who I liked very much indeed. And as I say, when I was thinking about writing a, if I call it a literary whodunit, that's probably overclaiming, but I mean a whodunit in the literary world, it just struck me as a really interesting idea to have an editor as the main character.
Well, for all of us editors, thank you.
I have to tell you that I very much love my editors. I am, I'm very lucky in that I've had the same editor at Walker Books, where my children's books are published, for something like 25 years now. And we're very, very close. And my editor at Random House, Selena, works very, very closely with me as well. And I always say that it is a big mistake for a writer to fall out or to undermine or to underestimate his or her editor.
And editors often are underestimated and are frequently in fiction, it seems, can be the bad guys or gals because writers are writing them. So I think it's really
true. In my book, Alan Conway, the writer, has a horrible relationship with his editor and treats her very badly. But then Alan Conway is not like me.
Well, hold that thought, because we're going to talk a little bit about that. So I'm just a reader, but it seemed to me after finishing Moonflower Murders and rereading most of Magpie Murders that the story, which is actually two stories, because you include the Atticus Punt, and I've got to ask you, did I pronounce Punt correctly?
You do, Punt. Atticus Punt. Punt is German for pound.
And we'll talk about that umlaut in a second. Atticus Punt takes the cake. Takes the case. The Alan Conway novel that sets Moonflower in motion is about relationships between writers and their characters, between writers and their editors, between husbands and wives, between lovers, between siblings, between people and their chosen work. So Susan Ryland, because she was Alan Conway's editor, is asked by the parents of a missing woman who claimed in a phone call to them to have identified the killer of a guest at their family's resort hotel after reading the Punt novel, agreeing to investigate. And this causes Susan to contemplate all of these various relationships. Am I right? Was that sentence just like way too long? Or am I overthinking, or am I just nuts?
Well, certainly not the last two. Relationships is what murder mystery is all about. I mean, I think it's a common mistake that people think that a murder novel is about murder. A murder is only an excuse to explore relationships. And what makes it interesting is that a murder raises expectations and it enlarges emotions. You don't murder somebody because you are mildly angry with them or for any small reason. You have to have a big reason and big emotions. And so if you're going to study relationships, particularly in a closed community, such as a hotel or a village, one thinks of Mary St. Mead and Agatha Christie or whatever, a murder is a fantastic starting point, but relationships is what it's all about.
So let's go back to Atticus Punn's name. And you know, I'm a little bit of a grammar wonk, and because I live in Southern California, not unused to seeing little pronunciation marks, tildes mostly. So I'm curious why there's an umlaut, because there's no other vowel. It's a long U sound regardless.
I think German words sometimes have I don't know. Actually, no one's ever asked me that question before. I thought that German words could have an umlaut, even if there was only one syllable and one vowel. But maybe I'm wrong, in which event you have just undone 6 years' work with one question. I don't think it terribly matters, to be honest with you, because the umlaut is there because I liked it and I thought it looked good. And as to the grammatical niceties of it, although I am myself very, very stringent in my use of grammar and in the use of language, I love good writing. I like classical writing and try to write as well as I can when I'm doing my own books. I was determined to have that umlaut, and no one is taking it away.
Which reminds me a little bit of the Magpie Murders, because there was an article that Alan Conway insisted be there or not be there.
That is absolutely correct. And the title, Magpie Murders, his editor mistakenly describes it as the Magpie Murders, and he gets very agitated about it. But that is in itself a clue as to what's going on. It's a very tricky little clue, but that's what it is.
You have time traveled pretty extensively, you know, writing about spies and detectives, and you've gone through alternate realities and a target audience, more than one target audience, because you do write YA. So you've been to the late 19th century, the early 20th century. You've been in the Sherlockian universe with the House of Silk and Moriarty. You've been in World War II with Foyle's War, Between the Wars with Poirot, more or less current with your recent books, including the stories with Susan Ryland and Daniel Hawthorne. And you have Anthony Horowitz as a character. What do you pack into your metaphorical kit bag when you move from era to era, audience to audience?
Well, I mean, those are two very different questions. And I should add, incidentally, that I've also written a book set in the time of William Shakespeare. So I've even been back as far as the 17th century, 16th indeed. Let's start with the audience. Audiences are not in my thoughts when I'm writing, not particularly. That is to say, I don't say to myself, oh, this book is for children, or this book is for adults, therefore I must write in a different way. I think that way destruction lies. I do not think about the age, the gender, the ethnicity, the cultural background of people who might read my books. I think of the story. I live inside the book. If you're thinking about readers, you are automatically, by definition, outside your book, because you are thinking of the book in a market. Whereas I tend to write from inside the book, so I'm only thinking of the characters and the world and the descriptions of what I'm seeing around me inside those covers. So that's half the question. The other half of your question about different timescales, it's still the same answer, because when I'm writing Sherlock Holmes or James Bond, Cold War or whatever, Foyle's War, Second World War, I have done enough research before I start writing to be able to sort of live inside the world. I mean, occasionally, particularly when I'm writing James Bond, I'll have to stop and do a Google search to find out what type of tire a car might have had in 1950-something, because Fleming's world is so precise in its sort of origins and so precise in its trademarks and its labels, and you have to get it right all the time. And worse than that, you have to get it right according to Bond, who is a bit of a snob and has to have therefore the right clothes, the right cars, the right food. So that takes a certain amount of thought, and it is a bit of a stop-start process. But generally speaking, when I'm writing, I am well enough immersed in the world. I read an awful lot of 19th century literature to be able to just feel comfortable there and not to have to be floating in and out of Wikipedia.
And I would think perhaps living in London might help you with some of this, because you're surrounded by the same locations that Shakespeare, and I apologize for that, that one slipped through, Shakespeare might have walked, certainly World War II and Foyle's War and Poirot, who lived... Did he live in North London? It sort of looks
well,
like...
as it happens, I live in Clerkenwell, and Clerkenwell is an area of London which absolutely captures all these different epochs. I mean, I'm a 15-minute walk from the original site of the Globe Theatre for Shakespeare. I'm a 15-minute walk from Charles Dickens's home. Fagin from Oliver Twist lived round the corner from me. I'm a 2-minute walk from a place called Bleeding Heart Yard, which turns up in two of his novels, Bleak House, Miss Flight lives there. The Poirot TV series, done by ITV for many, many years, starring David Suchet, the house where, the flat where Poirot lived, is again 1 minute from my door. So I do have all these things right on me. Although, having said that, I'm at this moment outside London, I'm in Suffolk, and I'm looking at a river, and I write just as happily here. So I draw on the outside world, but I don't need absolutely to be in it all the time.
So I want to shift a little bit to the relationship between writers and their characters. Conan Doyle famously hated Sherlock Holmes, and Alan Conway hated Atticus for many of the same reasons, that the detectives were not the stuff of serious fiction, and you seem to be very hard on your characters that happen to be writers, including Anthony Horowitz. So I want to know why.
I mean, again, there are two questions there. You're absolutely right, first of all, but you've identified the inspiration for both Magpie Murders and Moonflower Murders. I love Sherlock Holmes, I love Conan Doyle, and I've always been fascinated by the fact that Doyle really did not like Sherlock Holmes to the extent that after only three or four books, he threw him off a fountain, putting to death his greatest creation, and only brought him back to life again for financial reasons when he needed to pay the mortgage on his new home. And I find that fascinating, that Doyle saw Holmes and murder fiction, murder mystery, whatever you want to call it, as beneath him. And he thought that his books and the books that people would love him for and remember him for were books like Micah Clark and The White Company, which is sort of historical romances, both of which actually I have read, but very, very few other people have. They are sort of forgotten and out of print. And I think that's interesting. You could also say, incidentally, we mentioned Bond earlier, that Ian Fleming had a love-hate relationship with Bond and killed him at the end of From Russia with Love and again at the end of You Only Live Twice, and sort of often felt that he was a children's book character and somehow not worthy of him. He was a little, when he wrote the first book, he was actually embarrassed by it and didn't know what a publisher would make of it. And I think he even wanted to submit it under a false name. And Agatha Christie too had a rant about Poirot at one stage. So I do think it is a very interesting phenomenon, the writer who doesn't like his main character. The second part of your question, which is, again, an interesting one, it hasn't been said to me before, that I am very hard on the writers in my books, including myself. I think, I'm trying to think if that is even true, but yes, being a writer is so strange. Writers are such odd people. The whole experience, the world, my world, of being a writer, not an entirely happy one, and not an entirely fulfilling one. It might lead me, perhaps, to have my doubts about the wisdom of becoming a writer. But of course, you know, people like me couldn't have gone to medical school, couldn't have done anything. I had no skills, no abilities outside the ability to tell stories. So I was always a one-trick pony, and I'm extremely fortunate. And incidentally, going back on what I've just said, don't get the idea that I am not 100% happy to be a writer. I am living the dream. This is all I can do. It's all I ever wanted to do. I love writing with a passion. I love my books. I love other people's books. I love reading and literature. The whole world, particularly now, when the world is falling apart all around me in every possible way you can imagine a world can self-destruct, it is doing it. What escape is there that is better than opening a book and diving into those pages and going to other places?
Amen to that. The current times seem to beg the question, and you touched on this, the world is falling apart. Books are, for many of us, our only respite, with a little bit of Netflix into the mix. So how are you coping? And you're an established writer with a fan base, a huge fan base, I might say. So how has the pandemic changed how you are approaching the launch of Moonflower Murders? I am cognizant of the fact that we are having this Zoom interview, and you might not have had time otherwise, so I'm thankful in a way. Those are two questions, too.
Well, first of all, I'm not coping that well with it, if you want to be honest, if you want the truth. I find I can't speak for how things are in America or Canada, but in England, this is an incredibly unhappy time. I mean, we feel very adrift. There is no consensus on where we are. Nobody seems to know the truth about what is going on. And I feel personally very isolated. Although it's a pleasure to speak to you, I am not a great fan of Zoom. I miss human contact. I wish I could be traveling in America right now, you know, talking to even 10 or 20 people in a bookshop. Is, you know, I can reach 10,000 people maybe on a Zoom call, but I like to meet the 10, 20, 30 people in a bookshop in San Francisco or in Los Angeles or in New York or wherever I can get to on an American tour. I miss all that terribly. I miss human contact. You know, I joke sometimes that as a writer, I've been in self-isolation for over 30 years. And it is true, I do spend an enormous amount of time by myself. But even when I'm by myself, I am plugged into a world that is happening around me. I'm seeing people, I'm hugging people, I'm holding on to people. I'm hearing sounds in the street. There isn't a sense of fear and oppression that I have around me all the time, and emptiness. So it has been very, very difficult. I mean, writing hard. I've written a new book. I finished it only yesterday, in fact, during current sort of session, you know, this current COVID situation. And yet it is very hard to focus, very hard to sleep, very hard to keep my spirits up. And I am turning more and more to books, reading an enormous amount, less so Netflix, to be honest with you, but just simply to stay sane.
You know, it's interesting. I've had a number of interviews since the COVID started. I've started to ask this question of every writer, and every writer, there seems to be two camps, yours, and then Denise Mina, who I spoke to about a month ago, who said, well, you know, anxiety is her happy place for being a prolific writer. So she's sort of churning that into output, which you've kind of answered in the same way
Well, to an extent, I mean, I agree with Denise to this extent that I've always said that all writing and possibly all art requires tension. I don't think you can be a completely happy person and totally satisfied. Of course, there are exceptions to this rule. There are no rules in the world of culture. But I think it is difficult to be totally happy and to be a successful writer. I've always thought that it's a spark. It's something rubbing against something inside your psyche that creates whatever it is you are creating. And I've had plenty of experiences in my lifetime that have created enough tension to keep me writing for another 100 years. So I don't need the worry, the anxiety, and the misery of COVID to help me with my writing in any way at all. And I resolutely refuse, when I'm asked, to see anything positive in what has happened this year in terms of the politics, the ecology, the society as destroyed by this pandemic. You know, there are some who say that it's wonderful there are fewer planes, and it's wonderful that you know, that the streets are quieter and we have more time to be with our family. We all look for silver linings, but for heaven's sake, this is one grey cloud I wish would just go away.
No, I agree with you. This is horrible. You're absolutely right.
I think we're underestimating the mental pandemic that is going to come, which is already here and following on the heels of this physical pandemic. Because if you live your life how we're living it now for too long, who can say what the psychological destruction of it is? The way, you know, just the amount of anger that we have in this country at the moment, and the amount of bloody mindedness, actually. It's very, very difficult to sort of recognize my own country at this present time.
You know, and it's an interesting dichotomy, because you talk about the mental, the isolation and the mental anguish and all of these really bitter and nasty pills we're swallowing. And yet there's this false connectiveness with social media, where people think they are connected and they can talk to each other. You talk about the bloody mindedness in the UK. Well, I have a feeling we might have infected you.
Well, social media is one of the great paradoxes of our time, because although it supposedly brings us all together, I can think of nothing which is more divisive. Social media is what actually tears us apart. And when you look at some of these big platforms, such as Twitter, for example, which I do use, you see that argument and black and white and dissension and conspiracy theory and just sheer old-fashioned rage rule and are dominated to a terrible extent. Therefore, that human discourse, civil discourse, is almost something antiquated now. And I do blame social media for that.
Yes,
I think it's deadly, but in terms of politics, some of the tweets put out by politicians and the language that they now use on a routine basis I've managed to get into my 60s without hearing it before on a public platform, and now it is commonplace. And I think that is also incredibly destructive, that language, which is something so beautiful. I mean, I deal in words. I've written millions and millions of words. Occasionally, I write unpleasant words because one has to. I don't really like using bad language, but in order to reflect life, you have to. But actually, if you read Austen or Hardy or any of the great poets, and you realize how wonderfully soothing and elegant and civilizing good language can be, you understand why Twitter, with its 140 character bites of unpleasantness, can be so damaging.
I agree, absolutely. And something flashed through my mind when I was still at the Los Angeles Times. I had to speak to the copy chief, the managing editor for copy for the newspaper, because I was the editor of the magazine, and we had a quote with an F-bomb. And the F-bomb was, it was integral to the quote. And I agree with you. I don't like to use bad language. I don't like to use bad language in a paper of record. So I went to talk to him, and he's a wonderful guy. And he said, Nancy, when the president of the United States uses the F word, that's when you can use it. And so the answer is no. And I figured that would be the answer, but I wanted to make a case. And he sent me an email, not, you know, about a year ago. He just said, I can't believe it. You know, I can't believe that there's a live quote in the New York Times and in the Los Angeles Times, which he has also left. With that, you know, that I think that's just a bridge too far. You know, it's the Rubicon, and it seems like we're hurtling into something I don't know language-wise. I'm only speaking in terms of language.
I think language can be an outlier. It points to the way you're going. But language used by people in public and people with responsibility is a very, very good signpost on the way which your society is going. And the uglier and the more violent the language, the uglier and more violent society is becoming.
All right. Let's not go any further down that road.
You started it.
I did. I started it. But, you know, you're a journalist. You know how it goes. You never know where the interview is going to go.
Listen, the only good interview is the interview that you don't know where it's going.
Well, thank you, then. So this is my final question, historically, unless you have something to add. You mentioned that you finished a book yesterday. Congratulations. I know. Have you pushed the send button yet? Or?
Oh, no. I finished the first draft. I've started rewriting it today.
Okay. So, but congratulations, nevertheless. Can you tell us about it?
It's the third Hawthorne novel. Hawthorne is a detective who has hired me to write about him. The first book was The Word is Murder. The next one was The Sentence is Death. This one, I'm not yet giving away the title because my publisher hasn't seen it. And she has a very nasty habit of not liking my titles and getting rid of them. So I don't want to announce it and put a curse on it before she's had a chance to at least hopefully buy it. I'm very, very happy with the book. I finished it. By that I mean that I've got to that wonderful section, the last 20-odd pages, where so many different lines set up, all the different clues, the red herrings, the suspects, the twists, the turns, all have to come together to a satisfying conclusion. And that conclusion is satisfying. It works. I don't think you can guess the answer, but it is a fun, you know, it's a fun resolution to this puzzle. So it is finished to that extent. Now I'm just sort of, you know, polishing up the language a little bit. It's set on a little tiny island called Alderney in the Channel Islands, where Hawthorne and I have been invited to our first literary festival. And the whole book takes place on this island, where there has never, in its entire history, and this is a fact, there has never been a murder on the island of Alderney. Not until we arrive.
I absolutely can't wait. And I hope you will join me again on the podcast, if heaven allows, and talk about it, because I think I've probably enjoyed this interview. I had a lot of the agita before, because I am a very, very big fan and in awe of your writing. So
Well, Nancy, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and I very much hope that we can talk about the new Hawthorne, maybe face-to-face. So where are you in America?
I'm in Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles. I love Los Angeles, and so maybe I'll be back there. I do a lot of film work myself in L.A. and come quite often, and I really hope that by next year I'll be back.
I'm here. I don't go anywhere. I don't think I'm going to
Nobody's going anywhere.
Nobody's going. Well, thank you again, Anthony Horowitz, for joining us on the podcast, Speaking of Mysteries, for your about-to-be-released Moonflower Murders, but also already released in the UK. It's sort of like a time zone thing, isn't it?
It's at least it's close. The last one was a year apart. Now I've managed to get it to just 2 months. So almost simultaneously. But I do hope that your listeners enjoy it.
Okay, well, thank you again. And I look forward to talking to you for the as yet unreleased name of your new book.
Thank you.